Good morning. Well, I think it's obvious that the reason that Scott chose this Ecclesiastes sermon series is so that my first time preaching at CAC, I have to preach on Ecclesiastes. The jig is up. We're going to take a look this morning at Ecclesiastes chapter 10. We'll read the chapter together and then we'll dive in to what this says and what it means for us. Ecclesiastes 10. As dead flies give perfume a bad smell, so a little folly outweighs wisdom and honor. The heart of the wise inclines to the right, but the heart of the fool to the left. Even as fools walk along the road, they lack sense and show everyone how stupid they are. If a ruler's anger rises against you, do not leave your post. Calmness can lay great offense to rest. There is an evil I have seen under the sun, the sort of error that arises from a ruler. Fools are put in many high positions, while the rich occupy the low ones. I have seen slaves on horseback, while princes go on foot like slaves. Whoever digs a pit may fall into it. Whoever breaks through a wall may be bitten by a snake. Whoever quarries stones may be injured by them. Whoever splits logs may be endangered by them. If the axe is dull and its edge unsharpened, more strength is needed, but skill will bring success. If a snake bites before it is charmed, the charmer receives no fee. Words from the mouth of the wise are gracious, but fools are consumed by their own lips. At the beginning, their words are folly. At the end, they are wicked madness, and fools multiply words. No one can tell what is coming. No one knows what is coming. Who can tell someone else what will happen after them? The toil of fools wearies them. They do not know the way to town. Woe to the land whose king was a servant, and whose princes feast in the morning. Blessed is the land whose king is of noble birth, and whose princes eat at a proper time, for strength and not for drunkenness. Through laziness the rafters sag, because of idle hands the house leaks. A feast is made for laughter, wine makes life merry, and money is the answer for everything. Do not revile the king, even in your thoughts, or curse the rich in your bedroom, because a bird in the sky may carry your words, and a bird on the wing may report what you say. Now, at first glance, this seems like a chapter that's kind of a hodgepodge of different ideas. You kind of, like with most of Ecclesiastes, you really have to sit in it and chew on it and wrestle with it to figure out what's the common thread. How do these ideas all fit together here? Some of them are perfect examples of why it's important not to take little pieces of scripture out of context. Money is the answer for everything. If we just left that alone, we would be led quite astray, even from what Solomon has been arguing in this very book. So Ecclesiastes is part of a genre within the Bible that we call wisdom literature, and Proverbs is probably the most commonly read and familiar book of wisdom in the Bible. If you've read Proverbs, if you're familiar with that book, it presents somewhat of a clear-cut picture of life. A lot of Proverbs presents this idea that if you act in wisdom, then things will go well for you, and if you act in folly, then things will go poorly for you. Ecclesiastes comes in and bucks against this. Solomon is essentially saying, I've seen a glitch in the system. It doesn't always work out the way that it's supposed to, that we think that it will. And as Scott discussed last week, you know, we see that in so many ways in our own lives, not just in Scripture, but in the fast not always winning the race, the strong not always winning the battle, the rich, the wise not always becoming rich, the foolish not always having their lives crumble. It's not as clear-cut as we might think that it should be when we read the book of Proverbs. No, that's not to say that there is not great and deep wisdom within Proverbs, but we take Scripture as a whole, and Ecclesiastes deepens our lens as we look into what is wisdom according to the Bible. So Ecclesiastes, once we read this, once we sit in this word meaningless and everything that we've been unpacking throughout the summer, it could bring us to a conclusion that would put us at odds with the rest of wisdom literature and the entire biblical narrative. If wisdom doesn't guarantee good things, then why should we act in wisdom at all? Why follow this advice if it's not always going to work out the way that we expect it to? But that's not Solomon's point, and at this point in the book, he's pulling back from railing against the absurdity, the perceived meaninglessness of life, and he's reminding us why wisdom is still good. It's still the way of life that we are called to as followers of God. So chapter 9 ended with wisdom exemplified, and chapter 10 is warning us about folly. So the chapter opens with this dead flies metaphor. Now, a lot of, especially the metaphors, the images that we encounter in Scripture, we don't really understand them until we get to know the context of that culture and the language and the history. This is one that I think we can all get it, right? Nobody wants dead flies in their perfume. We can picture how terrible that would be. Alicia loves essential oils. I don't know if there's any other essential oils people here this morning. So this image makes me picture some dead flies getting into her diffuser and just kind of, it's not good. But this is pointing back to the last verse of chapter 9. It says, "Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good." So we're contrasting wisdom and folly. This word sinner in this verse, as we read on, it becomes evident that Solomon isn't just talking about sin in the way that we often talk about it as breaking God's law, doing the wrong thing, but he's talking about foolishness. So again, chapter 9 exemplified wisdom at the end, and chapter 10 is moving on to warn us, this is what folly looks like. This is the opposite, or the lack of wisdom. Flies are really small, and dead flies are, well, they're dead. So we wouldn't think they could do much, but they can wreak plenty of havoc in a situation like this. Derek Kidner says, "It is easier to make a stink than to create sweetness." We get this. This is the reality of life. It takes so much work to build something, to cultivate something, to make something good. But all you have to do to ruin something is just sit still. And later in the chapter, Solomon speaks directly on this, of the foolishness found in laziness. Through laziness, the rafters sag because of idle hands. The house leaks. All we have to do is just sit still, sit on our hands, and things fall apart. If we want to build something, improve something, we have to put our hands to the task. We have to put in the work. Verse 2 goes on and talks about the heart inclining to the right and the left. Let me assure you, Solomon is not talking about American politics in this image. He's talking about the right hand and the left hand. The right hand in this culture and in many ancient cultures signified strength, blessing, and authority. I'm left-handed. I don't like that, but it's just true. It's the way it is. This is essentially a poetic way of saying that wisdom is better, it's stronger, it is more blessed than folly. And we often know the difference between good and evil. When we have to decide, when we have to make a decision, and there's something that's good that honors God, and there's something that's evil that clearly is sin, it's often hard to follow through with that choice. But in just discerning what the right choice, what the godly choice is, that's not that difficult. If we can identify good from evil, we know what we should do. Again, following through is a different story often. But the choice between wisdom and folly, to discern what is wise and what is foolish, is often much, much harder to distinguish. And so Solomon is giving us examples of both. Now, he says a lot about kings and rulers in this chapter, but the lesson here is not specifically about rulers and governments. He's reinforcing his teachings about wisdom by revealing more about the flip side, which is folly. So we hear in verse 3 that fools make their foolishness known. Fools are obvious once they go about their lives making foolish decisions. We see a lot of parallels to this in Proverbs. A few examples. In Proverbs 17:7, eloquent lips are unsuited to a godless fool. How much worse lying lips to a ruler? Proverbs 18:2, fools find no pleasure in understanding, but delight in airing their own opinions. And later in that same chapter, the lips of fools bring them strife. This is my favorite part. And their mouths invite a beating. The mouths of fools are their undoing, and their lips are a snare to their very lives. Someone has said, this is one of those quotes that, you know, it's probably been attributed to Mark Twain. Who knows who actually said it or said it first. But it's better to remain silent and be thought a fool than to open your mouth and remove all doubt. We've all had that experience, at least I have had that experience way more often than I wish, of saying something stupid and letting everyone know how dumb we actually are. You can hear yourself saying the words, and they come out of your mouth, and you can kind of feel them going out into the world, never to return, and it's like, no, but it's gone. It's too late. Once you say it, there's no taking it back. Foolishness is evident in the lives of fools. So we see this image now that Solomon paints for us in verses 5 to 7. In his time, social status was evident in how people traveled, among other things. But traveling was one of those things that you could generally tell where someone fits on the social ladder. Those who rode nice horses were the rich and powerful, not just the people who called shotgun. You'd assume those in prominent positions are the best of the best and deserve to be there, but that those in lowly positions are lazy or unintelligent or not fit to rule. But Solomon tells us that this isn't necessarily true. This again goes back to what Scott unpacked for us last week. The world is made up of foolish people, and so in our folly, we set fools in positions of power and influence, and then this kind of influence trickles down into all of society. So when you see people, when you notice what's going on in the world, Solomon's saying don't assume wisdom or folly in someone based on their station in society or their life situation. There are fools everywhere. He goes on to give some examples of how foolishness is predictable. We know what the outcome will be when we make foolish decisions. This reminds me of Wile E. Coyote. If you grew up watching Looney Tunes, or maybe you still do on Saturday mornings, Wile E. Coyote's trying to get this Roadrunner. The Roadrunner always has some sort of trick up his sleeve. We know what's going to happen, right? There's always the tunnel that the coyote thinks he's about to go through is always the side of a mountain. Right? There's always an anvil about to drop from the sky onto his head. We know what's going to happen. He's predictable. This isn't just on Looney Tunes, though. This is all over TV and movies. In fact, there's a trope, a kind of a repeated theme over and over again that has been called the two-timer date, where you've seen it somewhere, where a character winds up committed to be in two places at once or to be on a date with two different people at the same time. This happens in an episode of the show Malcolm in the Middle, where Malcolm winds up asking a girl to the spring dance and then saying yes to a girl who asks him to the spring dance, and he realizes what's happening and says, oh man, I've got two dates to the spring dance. It's sort of like that episode of, well, every show. We've seen this over and over again. We know what's going to happen, and I, for one, am tired of watching these TV characters ruin their lives by following the same old pattern. Maybe not with that two-timer date trope, but in other ways, I see the same kinds of foolishness creep up in my life over and over again. Even though it's predictable, I know what the outcome's going to be, and I keep making dumb decisions. I keep saying dumb things. Dan Allender is a counselor and a psychologist, and he's been invited into the lives of many, many people to give insight, to walk through their journey with them, and he has seen this: a fool will follow a path that seems to be right, even when the blacktop gives way to gravel, and gravel to dirt, and dirt to rocks and debris. Almost nothing will stop the fool from plunging ahead into peril. We've seen this. And the reality that Solomon is teaching us in this first part of the chapter is that there are serious consequences to a life of folly. Serious consequences. Jesus talks about this. He says, the wise man builds his house upon the rock. The foolish man builds his house upon the sand. You can build a great, glorious, beautiful, energy-efficient, wonderful house that was designed by Joanna Gaines, but if you build it on sand, it's going to crumble, no matter how much effort and work and brilliance was put into the design. Your foundation is in the wrong place. There are serious consequences to a life of folly. So Solomon goes on. He's talked about, you know, we see fools in positions of leadership, of influence, of authority, and now he's telling us what happens when fools have power. We see in this part of the chapter, when a fool is given authority and influence, those consequences broaden to include the lives of everyone they touch. So as an individual, if you make foolish decisions, then that, you know, it's predictable. We know what's going to happen, that those decisions are going to come back to bite you. They're going to ruin your life if they keep adding up. But if you're in power, if you have any level of influence, and you have a heart inclined to folly, then everything you do will reflect that folly, and that doesn't just impact you, but it impacts everyone around you, everyone who is affected by your influence. So all this talk about folly, about how terrible it is, about the serious consequences that come when your heart is inclined to folly, it begs the question, well, what is folly? Because again, this isn't just talking about good versus evil, it's talking about wisdom versus folly, which is a harder thing to discern oftentimes. Now, this may be an encouragement to you. When Solomon is talking about folly, when the Bible as a whole talks about wisdom versus folly, he's not talking about the grades that you got or get in school. He's not talking about your IQ. He's not talking about the level of knowledge that you have on any particular subject. It's often said that knowledge is what you know, and then wisdom is the ability to apply that knowledge. But biblical wisdom is even deeper than that. Again, to come back to Proverbs, in Proverbs 9:10, we're told that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. So there's a lot of people who can learn knowledge and then apply it to their lives, but biblical wisdom, godly wisdom, is fearing the Lord. And if we look at Psalm 14, in the beginning of this psalm, it says, the fool says in his heart, there is no God. So wisdom is fearing the Lord. Foolishness is rejecting God. This is why Solomon talks about the way in which the hearts of the wise and the fools are inclined. This isn't just about making bad choices. It's about rejecting the very source of wisdom, the one who wrote it into the very blueprint of the universe. Solomon's not just talking about people who do wise things or people who do foolish things. He's talking about those who are wise and those who are fools. It's a state of being. The fool might try to go the right direction, as we saw in that Dan Allender quote, but he's actually walking on the wrong road. And even if you start out just the slightest degree off course, as you continue on that path, eventually you get farther and farther from the right path. and it results in getting very, very lost. So if this is folly, then how do we get wise? First, we have to acknowledge where we truly are. Charles Spurgeon says, "The doorstep to the temple of wisdom is the knowledge of our own ignorance." So we'll jump back to Psalm 14 here, and we'll see that according to a biblical worldview, everyone apart from Christ is a fool. In that psalm, as we continue on, the fool says in his heart, "There is no God. They are corrupt. Their deeds are vile. There is no one who does good. The Lord looks down from heaven on all mankind to see if there are any who understand, any who seek God. All have turned away. All have become corrupt. There is no one who does good, not even one." And so according to this, I'm a fool and we're all fools in our sin. And before we think that this is, you know, just a particular situation that the psalmist is speaking to there, Paul speaks to this reality and applies it to all of humanity in the book of Romans when he says, "There is no one righteous, no, not one, for all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God." So the fool says in his heart, "There is no God." You may not have ever claimed literally that there is no God, but apart from Christ in our sin, we've all rejected God in our hearts. By biblical standards, that makes us all fools. Our hearts are inclined to folly. And Solomon spoke of what happens when our leaders are fools. So in light of this perspective, every government, every business, every school, every organization, every church, every ministry, every team, every committee, every family, everything is led by fools. And so it's clear that we need wisdom. We need it desperately. So that question, how do we become wise? I have some highly scientific charts here. If wisdom is at the top of the chart and folly at the bottom, and then we put the average person, you know, somewhere in the middle with the kind of ability to do some wise things and some foolish things. According to this vision of reality, the more you increase your wise choices, the more you do wise things, the more you gain wisdom, the more you become a wise person, and vice versa. The more you do foolish things, the more you make foolish choices, the more you become a foolish person, the more your heart is inclined to folly. But this is not the reality that we see in the Bible. That's how we think becoming wise works. But here's how the gospel says becoming wise works. We have Jesus at the top. Jesus is wise. He is wisdom. And at the bottom, in the place of folly, is you and me as fools. And what Jesus does is he gives in his wisdom, in his goodness and love and mercy, he dies for us, takes on our sin and therefore our foolishness. And then in his resurrection, he invites us into life. He invites us into his wisdom. He gives us his wisdom. This is the gospel's understanding of how we become wise. We can't do it on our own strength. We don't do it on our own life choices. We do it because Jesus has allowed us to, and he does the work on our behalf. My coworker Paul Harbison, his favorite quote, I've heard him say it many times. He's a guy who carries a compass around. You know, he doesn't wear a watch. He carries a compass everywhere he goes. And he says, "Direction is everything. Distance is secondary." It's not so much about how many wise choices we are making to progress towards wisdom. It's about the direction we are pointed. Is our life pointed towards Christ? Is our heart inclined towards him? And if it is, then in Solomon's words, our heart is inclined to the right, to the wise, to the better life. So we've been looking at a couple points at Psalm 14. And where we left off, things look pretty bleak. No one is wise. Everyone is a fool. But if we continue on in the psalm, we'll see that it actually points to redemption. Do all these evildoers know nothing? They devour my people as though eating bread. They never call on the Lord. But there they are, overwhelmed with dread, for God is present in the company of the righteous. You evildoers frustrate the plans of the poor, but the Lord is their refuge. Oh, that salvation for Israel would come out of Zion. When the Lord restores his people, let Jacob rejoice and Israel be glad. This is pointing ahead in the story to what God is going to be doing long before Jesus comes onto the scene. The psalmists and the prophets start imagining and envisioning what it would look like to be saved, what it would look like for God to bring redemption to his people. And we're on the other side of that redemption narrative. We look back at what Jesus has done. And so here are the good news. Psalm 14, both in its recognition of the reality that we find ourselves in, and in its longing for the story to continue towards redemption, is fulfilled in Jesus. Salvation has come out of Zion. The Lord is restoring his people, and therefore we can rejoice and be glad. These problems, these issues that we see because of our folly as individuals, because of the folly of our leaders, of our entire world, they are fulfilled in Jesus, because in Jesus we have a good king who rules with perfect wisdom and justice. Solomon laments what happens when fools are on the throne, when fools are in positions of leadership. And we know that the source of wisdom is the one on the true throne. He's above all. So despite the reality of foolish leaders bringing strife, chaos, and injustice, we are citizens of God's kingdom and we bow to his perfect rule. And the good news goes further. This king doesn't just rule over his people, but he transforms his people into his image as he invites us into his life. And so in Jesus, we are given all wisdom from the very source of wisdom. In Jesus, we're freed from the rat race of trying to become wise in the eyes of the world and trying to make wise choices on our own strength. We don't have to strive and grasp at wisdom and fear falling into folly because we're freed from that reality. James 1:5 says, "If any of you lacks wisdom, you should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to you." I don't know about you, but that's good news for me. The choices, again, there are choices of good and evil that If we're seeking God and relying on his strength, you know, we know what's right and we follow what's right. Not in every situation, but in many situations. But those choices of what is wise and what is foolish, or even sometimes more complex, what is maybe a little bit wise, but what is very wise, that can weigh down on us like a burden in our jobs as we seek to honor God in the minute realities, the day-to-day parts of our lives, as parents, as spouses, in all of our relationships, and in everything that we do, there are so many difficult decisions to make, where the answer isn't clear cut, where we wish that there was just a good, godly choice that stands out above the rest, and we just don't see that. But God invites us through Jesus and what he's done for us to seek him, to allow his spirit to direct us and to guide us. And that doesn't always make those choices easy, but it takes that burden off of us because we know that we have a guide. We have a leader. We have a good king who, again, isn't just ruling over us, but inviting us into his life. And so Jesus makes sinners righteous. He makes the broken whole, and he makes fools wise. And that is very good news.